Because most ordinary people these days do not get their information even from the print media. They get it largely from television. So the wars that we see have also become wars of images. And that is why, when the United States is about to fight a war, they prepare plans for targeting television stations that might report news which doesn't tally with the mainstream images being presented to the Western public. And you have the way they bombed the Al Jazeera offices in Kabul at the beginning of the Afghan War, the targeting of Tariq Ayub, the chief Al Jazeera correspondent in Baghdad, the week the occupation began. And you can see on the screen, some of you may have seen it in this excellent documentary called The Control Room, of the guys reporting from the top of a roof, and a helicopter comes and fires missiles at him, deliberately to kill him, which they succeed in doing. And more recently, an Al Jazeera reporter was picked up simply because he was an Al Jazeera reporter, taken into Abu Ghraib prison and tortured. Why? Why are they so obsessed with it? Because they know that the wars they fight are being fought on extremely flimsy grounds. And if alternative images of what these wars are doing get out, there will be an outcry. So the key thing is to keep the population depoliticized. Don't show it images which get it worked up, unless these images are used to get people worked up to participate in and support a war. So they can be very partial. I give you another example. About 2 months ago, 2.5 months ago, I was in Qatar, tiny Arab state, which has two tourist attractions. One is Al Jazeera television, and the other is the Al Adid base, the largest US military base in the world. They're about 5 miles from each other. So I was talking to the general manager of Al Jazeera, and I said, what are the pressures on you guys? Because, you know, some of your reporting is quite amazing. Does the government here? He said, the government doesn't interfere. They let us get on with it. So I said, what happens then? He said, well, you know, 2 weeks ago, one of our crews in Iraq, and we have 18 crews in Iraq reporting every day. One of our crews in Baghdad captured an image of an American tank commander firing on a car. And he carried on filming, and he got the images, and the car was burnt. And in the car, sitting in the front, were the mother and father, and in the back were three children. They were all killed. So he said it was a horrific but very important story of what is actually happening on the streets in Baghdad. And we know, he said to me, from CNN and BBC World, these images aren't reported. They aren't even shot in most cases. So we led our news bulletins with it. He said after the second news bulletin went out, someone came running and said that the commander of the US military base, General X, with an armored convoy of three carriers, has just entered the Al Jazeera compound, and he's marching straight to your office. So he said he walked into my office. I said, hi, General, how are you? Sit down, what can we do for you? And he said, I've just seen these images you put out on Al Jazeera. And it's images like these that are creating anti-Americanism in the world. So the boss of Al Jazeera said, he said, General, with great respect, he's a very calm guy, he never loses his cool. He said, with great respect, do ask yourself, is it the images that are creating it or what you're actually doing? Just think about it for a bit. And the general said, yes, but you know, of course it happened, I don't doubt that. But did you know what was in the mind of the tank commander? Did you report what he was thinking when he did that? So the guy said, no, how can we tell what's in the mind of people? You know, we're not mind readers. And the general said, he obviously thought that this car was packed with terrorists. And you should have reported it, that this was a terrible tragedy in an accident because the American tank commander thought he was firing on terrorists. So the guy said quietly, he said, we let CNN do that. And the general then said, I demand an apology. And the Al Jazeera guy said, General, if we're talking about apologies, then we need one from you, because what you've been doing to us now for the last 5 years, killing our people, bombing our headquarters, and when you apologize to us in public, then you come back and we'll discuss anything else. And at this point, the general said, I don't know about these events. He told his deputy officer, you take this down, and walked out. And I just carry on stressing this to you to show how important the role of the media has become. It's become, even more than ever before, a central ideological pillar of the war regime. They cannot do without it. And therefore, fighting for space within the mainstream media, I mean, it's a task which has to be carried on. But it's increasingly being narrowed down. And I'm prepared to bet it's not so different in Canada either. It's a general pattern now, which we see in the advanced Western world, that there was a limited period in the run-up to the war where they were beginning to allow voices because of the millions who came out on the streets. They couldn't totally deny us a presence. But now it's back to normal as they try and present a situation in Iraq as it's virtually normal. You know, there's an elected government, it'll be like any other country very soon. Well, it won't be as long as the United States stay there. And the big debate which is going on in the United States within the anti-war movement between the more liberal elements and the more left-wing elements is the following. They all want to withdraw, but the more liberal elements within the anti-war movement says, however, there is a point in what our leaders say when they say if we were to leave now, there would be a mess. To which I replied, you go in and invade a country, you occupy it, you create a big mess, you try and divide the country along ethnic grounds, constantly talking about Shia and Sunna and Sunna and Shia and Kurds, talk of this sort which had not been heard in Iraq before under any government. You go in and do that. You cannot stabilize the country. You cannot even stabilize the green zone in Baghdad where all of the top people live. Recently, some US congressmen went into that green zone and were told you can't sleep here tonight because it's not safe. And if you were killed, it would be an awful propaganda blow. And one of these congressmen describes how even when he went to use the toilet, some Marines went with him, which couldn't have been a pleasant experience. So they cannot even secure the green zone in Baghdad. And Baghdad is a city of 6 to 7 million people, a sprawling metropolis like Los Angeles. And it's a mixed city, Sunni, Shia, Kurd, Christian, they all live there. They can't maintain stability even in one city. And if and when sections of the Shia bloc break, as I predict they will, sooner rather than later, then they will not be able to control the southern cities either. So what's this talk about if we leave there'll be a mess? You go in, you create a mess, and you say we can't leave because if we leave there will be a mess. It's a circular argument. It's true it's not going to be easy for the Iraqis, given this scale of destruction, but they will manage. Because Iraq, unlike many other countries in that region, was an extremely well-educated country in terms of the level of culture. You had vast numbers of engineers, doctors, architects. Saddam had many vices. He was a brutal tyrant in many ways in terms of political repression, in terms of social welfare, and the education of women. and men from poor families, that went ahead. So Iraq has a big, big reservoir of skilled and very advanced skilled labor. They can reconstruct their country themselves. They're not that keen on Halliburton and Bechtel to come in and do it for them. In fact, they don't want these companies, which is why many of these companies are being targeted as well. As a statement by Iraqis, we don't want you here. And where is the oil? When Wolfowitz, now the president of the World Bank, appropriate position, was asked, how will you fund this war? Because the last time you took out Iraq, because it intervened in Kuwait, you got money from the Arab states. The Saudis more or less paid for the war. No one's paying it this time. How are you going to fund it, given the state of the US economy? And both Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld replied, think about this. The sales of Iraqi oil will help us to fund the war. So you take a country, you take its oil, you sell it, and you think that that oil will fund the war. But they haven't been able to get the oil wells working. Over the last 18 months, I think there have been up to 1,800 or 1,900 attacks on the oil pipelines. They can't keep them going. And that is an indication of how deep this business goes. Now, people ask, what are the similarities with Vietnam? And since it was 30 years ago this weekend that those amazing images of the US fleeing Saigon and people clinging onto the helicopters startled the world, because it was the first time an imperial power, the United States as an imperial power, had been humiliated in public. That's what had happened. Now, that's what had happened, and people had said that could never happen, but that had happened 30 years ago today. So what are the similarities with Vietnam? There aren't all that many analogies, and I'll tell you why. A, we live in a different epoch. It is not the epoch of the 20th century. It's a different epoch that we live in. Secondly, the Iraqi resistance, unlike the Vietnamese resistance, is not a unified resistance. The Vietnamese had a unified armed and a political resistance, which functioned globally. Everything they did, everything was targeted at American public opinion, and they were very successful at that. Very successful. In this case, that is not so. Resistance comes from different political currents of thought. There is a strong religious component to it. They are not unified. It's decentralized. There are advantages in that, that it becomes impossible in a way to crush them because no one knows who or where they are. The one thing we do know, which I would advise you all to be very careful about, is that the presentation by the Western media of this tiny group led by Abu Musa al-Zarqawi is very suspicious and dodgy. And very few Iraqis believe in this group. Most of them hate it, and most of them regard it as a group of provocateurs. And what makes it even more difficult is that the real Zarqawi is supposed to be dead. Guy in his late 50s with one leg, who was the deputy of Osama bin Laden. And the Zarqawi presented on the television screens is a sprightly 30-year-old. Who, rumor has it, used to work for Jordanian intelligence. And given that Jordan is basically an Israeli-US protectorate at the moment, it does make you think of what is going on. So I would not take any of the writings on this guy seriously. If Zarqawi was the only force in the country, we would be in real trouble. The fact is there is a very deep, unarmed and armed resistance which takes place in Iraq, and despite its weaknesses, it has prevented the United States from claiming the war as a triumph. Because despite the images you use, despite the elections, the casualty figures continue to rise. The proportion of deaths now, that is roughly the equivalent of Vietnam. When the United States left Vietnam, the death toll was 50,000 US soldiers, and 2 million Vietnamese. The recent figures, 1,600 US soldiers and 100,000 plus Iraqis. So the proportions are the same, not so different. And that in itself is interesting. And even this level of resistance, the United States will not be able to crush without sending in 250,000 more troops. And that is impossible unless they introduce the draft. And any president who introduces the draft is signing the death warrant of his own political party. That, too, we know from history. So it's a very awkward situation for the United States, and it's a very desperate situation for Iraq.